Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the thing no parent or teacher can stop obsessing over, what are U.S. schools going to do about the fall term? We'll spend this hour with Education Week reporter Madeline Will, who's been reporting on options like in-school COVID testing to phased reopening to a variety of part-time schedules for student attendance. We'll talk about how many teachers might not be willing to come back to the classroom given risks to their own health, and about the effect of another weird semester on students' learning. Our conversation starts after a short break. In a school year like this one to come, administrators face a truly dizzying amount of decisions about how to retrofit learning spaces and retool schedules and policies. Teachers are scrambling to convert lesson plans and adjust teaching methods to accommodate the new arrangements. Parents are torn between worrying about the health hazards of sending their kids back to school in a pandemic and the development hazards of keeping them at home. And while we keep talking about needing to get this all sorted out by next fall, in a lot of places, the first day of school is just a few weeks away. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We wanted to get a sense of the options schools have for fulfilling their education missions without unduly risking the well-being of students and staff. There may be no perfect solution. And in fact, a lot of the options proposed have literally never been tried before. But that's where we are in 2020. And journalist Madeline Will, who reports for Education Week, is here to talk about how the next few months might play out. Madeline, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So at the moment, it seems the majority of K-12 public school systems around the country are planning to bring students back in some capacity in the fall. So I want to go through all the details that this will require. First and foremost is the question of transportation. Why is this such a big deal?
Transportation, a district leader say that is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, challenge that they're facing. Thinking about keeping 6 feet of distance, which is what the CDC recommends, between students on a school bus is just tricky. And so districts have to think, well, they don't have enough buses or bus drivers to accommodate that, but they can't afford to buy as many as they need. They would have to double or triple, even quadruple their size of their bus fleets. There's not even that many buses on the assembly lines. The supply is much less than the demand. So districts are thinking about finding creative ways for transportation, whether that's maybe limiting the number of students they pick up to vulnerable students, students who are homeless, students with disabilities, encouraging students to walk to school if they live within a 3-mile radius, encouraging carpool lines. I mean, they're having to get creative and see how they're going to do this, because it is going to be a big roadblock.
I mean, a 3-mile walk in each direction, it could be an hour each way. And that's assuming that students live along a path that would be safe to walk to school.
Yeah. So that's, I think it would vary by grade level. One state said high schoolers could do a 3-mile walk. Elementary school, they'd have to be closer to 1 mile. Some states are considering walking school buses, where a designated adult will walk along the route within a couple mile radius, and students will join along the way so that they do have some supervision, because there are safety concerns with that as well.
How might schools need to retrofit buildings to allow for the kind of social distancing that the CDC has recommended?
So the CDC has asked, has recommended 6 feet. And, you know, if you've been in a school building, you know that that's gonna be really tough. You have a lot of kids in a classroom. You're going to have to take out some of those desks if you're going to have 6 feet apart between the desks. The CDC recommends having desks facing all one direction, so no more kind of group tables, no more kids and tables. Hallways, kids are going to have to walk one ways down the hall. Hallway monitors are going to have to be making sure that kids are complying with social distancing there. Cafeterias might not be available for use. The CDC recommends that students eat their lunch in classrooms so that they are not congregating with the whole school community. Pickup lines, drop-off lines, all these places where just students congregate on typical school years, that we're going to have to rethink.
I'm thinking about passing periods as well between classes for older grades. I mean, the hallways are like a bumper car
Right.
course. Are they going to have to rethink moving students from one class to another, one part of a building to another throughout the day?
Yeah, so the CDC recommends that students sit today in one classroom the whole day. And, you know, if they're older, if they're in high school, typically they would move from class to class. And so maybe in that scenario, teachers would be the ones that move and students stay put.
Okay, and let's talk about some of the models that experts are weighing for schools. What is a phased reopening?
A phased reopening could be maybe you start schools being open for in-person instruction one day a week, and then gradually expand that as things as people get more comfortable, as transmission rates decline. Also, maybe you bring in elementary students at first, students who might have a harder time with remote learning, and then as things get better, you bring in older students until maybe you're at full capacity. You're taking it slowly.
That if buildings were only open, say, one day a week, I mean, I think about the administration challenges and how confusing that might be. The start of school in particular is always so hard. And it's like, where are we supposed to be and what are we supposed to have with us? That just seems like a real a scheduling challenge in terms of getting people to where they need to be, even for that one day a week.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be a very popular option. I think it's going to be challenging to establish routines when you do it that way.
And how would a system like that require teachers to change the way they work, trying to cram in, I guess, a week's worth of instruction into a single precious day?
Well, in those models, they would be doing remote learning the other few days. So it would be one day a week or in-person instruction, maybe 2 days a week. And then the rest of the time, they'd be remote learning. And those in-person days would be opportunities to build a teacher-student relationship.
How would a multi-track system work? What is that?
So that's where you have students, groups of students who are divided into cohorts. And some students are coming in on certain days. The other students are coming in. So maybe one group of students comes in Monday to Wednesday. The other group comes in Tuesday, Thursday. On Friday, everybody stays home.
And the advantages of that are what? That simply you don't have as many students in the building at any given time?
Yeah, exactly. So then maybe you could space out, use more classrooms, have more space in the classrooms.
And what happens on that Friday when the building is empty? It just gets cleaned every week?
Yeah, I think that would be a time for a deep cleaning. School districts, some are saying that during that one day of no in-person instruction, students could use it as a chance to have one-on-one conferences with their teachers through Zoom or get special support, or it could just be used as a teacher planning day.
All right. And the bubble method is the CDC's preferred strategy, right? What is the bubble method?
So that's where students stay in their cohorts. They stay in one classroom and they don't really leave that classroom throughout the day. And the classroom might be smaller than what we're used to.
I completely understand the logic of making the classroom smaller than it used to be or the class size smaller. But I mean, the schools that my kids attended were all pretty crowded. I can't think of where you would put students.
Yeah, so that's going to be a big challenge. I've spoken to district leaders who are thinking about converting the school library into classrooms, maybe the gym, the auditorium, the cafeteria. So just utilizing every space on campus. I've heard that some are thinking about outdoor classrooms, which, you know, might not be feasible depending on the weather where you live. But that could be a way to expand the space so we can get more students having instruction time.
Outdoor classrooms do sound like a good idea, although I imagine there are a lot of it's hard enough to keep students from looking out the window, you know, when the lecture gets a little long. Outside, there's a lot to look at and listen to.
Right. Yeah. And you'd have to, the districts would have to purchase tents maybe to make sure the kids are not getting too hot and accommodate that as well.
How do cyclical lockdowns work?
Yeah, so that's an interesting approach. So that would be 1 week of full-time in-person instruction and then 2 weeks of remote learning. And the idea is that during the 2 weeks, if you were exposed to COVID-19 when you're in the classroom, those symptoms will show up within the 2 weeks of remote time. And so then you can, you wouldn't go back to school until you're better. So the idea is that that would lessen the amount of disruptions and instances where schools have to abruptly shut down because a positive case was discovered.
I guess the hard part about that is thinking about younger students who are still adjusting to the idea of being in school. You start to get used to it on that 1 week on, then you're home again for 2 weeks. It just seems really hard to get into a rhythm.
Yeah, I think it'll be hard. I think it'll be hard for parents who are, trying to find childcare with that kind of untraditional arrangement. But I spoke to a school district superintendent in Oklahoma, and he said, the school year is going to be disrupted one way or another. At least this gives us some predictability.
Yeah. I mean, there are folks who bristle at the idea that schools serve a dual purpose in educating students and providing what amounts to childcare. I know teachers don't like to sort of have this referred to, but it's the reality, right? I mean, like, schools do allow students to be in a place that is safe and controlled while their parents are working. It may not have been set up for that purpose, but that's how it gets used.
Right. And, we know that parents have had a difficult time this past semester with their kids at home. And it's a roadblock to reopening the economy.
We haven't talked about a staggered school day. What does that mean, and how would it play out on campuses?
So that would be if maybe one group of students would come in the morning and the other group would come in the afternoon. And so that would allow you to have space out people in the building so you can have more room in the classrooms. Maybe that would allow you to avoid lunch altogether. You could just give students kind of a bag on their way out or their way in. You wouldn't have to deal with the cafeteria lines. And it would also maybe be helpful for transportation, say if you have fewer people on the bus at once.
All right, cafeteria lines are a thing. A lot of people listening might send their kids to school with a packed lunch, but schools are also a meal program for many, many millions of American children. What would happen to the way food is delivered to kids under any of these systems?
Yeah, so the CDC has recommended that you eat in your classroom, don't go to the cafeteria. And so that might mean instead of a hot lunch, you might get an individually packaged lunch. Avoiding the salad bars and buffet lines would also avoid using shared utensils and kind of dealing with that high touch areas.
And some schools are talking about moving to year-round scheduling. Why might that be helpful in reducing infection transmission?
So year-round, that would allow schools to build in more frequent breaks so that they could do deeper cleans, that they could maybe monitor, similar to the cyclical lockdown, monitor how people are, their exposure rates, and perhaps prevent as many unscheduled disruptions.
I have to imagine that people are frustrated. They're trying to make these plans, but it's not like there is evidence based research to guide these decisions. We're just sort of guessing about what might work best, right?
Yeah, it's, this is uncharted territory. We spoke to school leaders in other countries, but even those, it's hard to, it's not an apples to apples comparison because the United States have such a higher rate of transmission. So school leaders here are really going in blind.
Are they talking to leaders in other parts of the country? Are there a lot of teleconferences among, say, district administrators?
Yeah, I think district leaders are really looking for those case studies of how schools and across the world have reopened, because they did start reopening earlier in the spring.
My guest is Madeline Will. She's a reporter for Education Week. We're talking today about how schools are planning to reopen during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Go-to needs to be kids in school, in person, in the classroom, because we know for most kids, that's the best environment for them.
I understand that,
and
but
we have
what
to
if
also
they can't?
What if they can't what?
What if the school district feels that they can't safely go into the school because there is a flare-up in that district? Remote learning, are you okay with it in that situation?
If there's a short-term flare-up for a few days, that's a different situation than planning for an entire school year in anticipation of something that hasn't happened. That's a very different thing. Kids have got to be back in school. They've got to be back in the classroom.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos on CNN earlier this week talking about her adamant position that schools need to reopen and physically welcome students back. My guest this hour is Madeline Will, a reporter for Education Week. It is, a challenging position that everyone's in. I'm not unsympathetic to Secretary DeVos's position that, you know, the way we know how to teach students is with them physically in the classroom. I'm also very sympathetic to the concerns of parents and teachers that it may not be safe to do so. What do you think this will look like for science teachers who do their work in a science lab and can't necessarily translate that sort of thing into, you know, an English classroom where students don't move throughout the day?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that a lot of science teachers are thinking about. A lot of science classes having hands-on instruction where you're doing labs, you're working closely with other students. I talked to the National Science Teaching Association president, and she said that maybe we're going to have to rely a lot more on demonstrations where the teacher will do a lab and the students will watch, or maybe students can do the lab at home on their own time. But of course, that brings up some equity concerns and if students have those resources. But I think hands-on instruction in general is going to be a little bit limited in the fall.
All right. Earlier, we heard from Secretary Betsy DeVos, who is adamant, along with President Trump, that schools need to physically reopen and that that needs to be the plan for public schools in America. The question that I had for you is, are schools around the country feeling as much federal support as they are feeling federal pressure to physically reopen and welcome all students in the fall?
I think this is such a complicated, stressful time for school leaders and district leaders. I think the messaging that's going on in the federal government might be putting in state governments is put some pressure on them. I know that there is competing information going around with the CDC guidance. President Trump said that the CDC guidance might be impractical for schools to implement, but that is what district leaders have been building their plans around. So it's a lot of confusion, and the school year starts pretty soon.
Some schools have talked about doing regular COVID testing. I suppose you have to have parents' permission for this. I'm not quite sure how that works. Does every school even have a full-time nurse these days?
No. There's a lot of schools do not have a full-time nurse. And so that's something that school districts are thinking of. They're going to have to hire somebody. But actually, the CDC does not recommend universal testing for schools. They say that it's going to be a question of resources and student privacy, that it might just be better to focus on health screenings and making sure that students who are exhibiting symptoms are not going into school and are tested then.
How can schools plan for absences among teachers and staff who get sick themselves or need to stay home to care for a sick family member? I would imagine lots of people will be in a position that they can't work every day.
Yeah, that's I think it's going to be a big challenge for districts to figure out scheduling and staffing. Especially if the teacher is high risk themselves or they live with somebody who is, there's been possibilities floated where maybe those teachers could teach the students who are learning remotely. Mm-hmm. So focus on those students, or maybe shift to other roles. Like maybe they would teach an online elective class that students would take. But I think it's going to be a big challenge. And right now, a lot of teachers aren't sure what will happen if they need to quarantine for 2 weeks. If they get sick, how that's going to work with their sick days, with substitutes. It's a big unanswered question.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So there's the question of mask wearing. Are there universal rules that districts tend to be making about who is going to need to wear a mask on campus and who might not need to wear one and under what circumstances?
Yeah, so the CDC recommends that all staff members wear a mask, and they encourage students to wear them, especially older students. So it'll be up to states and districts on whether they decide to require students to wear masks. But I think that's been a big question for teachers who are in certain areas, how wearing a mask all day is going to work. Like if you're teaching young kids and teaching them how to read, that could be pretty tricky because kids look to your mouth to see how you're moving and sounding out letters and words. Teachers who are working with students who are just learning how to speak English, those students really rely on looking at their teachers' mouths and pronunciations and hearing how they're saying it and mimicking that. So that's a big question for teachers. And they're wondering maybe they need to wear face shields, maybe they need to wear those masks with like kind of a clear plastic insert so you can see the mouth.
Yeah, I've seen those online.
Yeah.
I wonder if they fog up, but I guess that's the least of anyone's concerns at this moment. Teachers in public schools in America, Madeline, have historically had to spend huge amounts of their own money outfitting their classrooms with school supplies and kind of enhancement materials. Is there reason to be concerned they will be on the line for like buying PPE for their classroom as well?
I think a lot of teachers are really concerned about that. They're concerned if they're, I mean, in before this, many teachers were tapped with buying their own hand sanitizers or, Lysol wipes. And so now they're wondering if they're going to have to do that now, if they're going to have to buy more, if they're going to have to, you know, buy their own masks and make sure that they're protected in that way. The CDC recommends against sharing school supplies because you don't want to be touching markers and stuff that other kids are also touching. So teachers are saying, well, that's going to be another big expense on me if I have to pay for individual sets for every student in my class.
What are teachers currently expecting, assuming that they go, let's just assume that at least they're going to go back in a few weeks and begin the fall term. What sort of slippage do they imagine they will have to make up for from last semester with their students?
I think they're concerned. It's going to take so long to find out exactly what learning loss students experienced over last semester. But initial research shows that the students did lose learning, and those achievement gaps have widened, especially for students who didn't have, you know, technology at home and lost that access. So teachers are worried about catching those students up academically, and they're also worried about meeting their students' social emotional needs. The students are scared, and this has been a really anxiety-inducing time. So teachers are expecting that if they do go back, they're going to have to spend a lot of time making their students feel comfortable.
A lot of parents feel like they have no choice but to return their kids to school if that's the plan. But are a lot of parents thinking that they need to quit work or stop working and stay home and try to start homeschooling their kids? Are people unwilling to send their kids back to public school right now?
I think that'll be the big question. Anecdotally, we've heard that maybe more people are interested in homeschooling, or maybe they're interested in hiring a private tutor for their kids. But I don't think we have numbers yet of how many are going to do that. But I think a lot of parents are worried about sending their kids back right now.
My guest is Madeline Will. She's a reporter for Education Week. We're talking about how schools are planning to reopen during the COVID-19 pandemic. The fall semester is supposed to begin in just a few weeks. Chris Boyd speaking this hour with Education Week reporter Madeline Will about how schools are planning to reopen during the COVID-19 pandemic. On the line is Evan in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Chris. My question pertains to fine arts programs, in particular band programs, where obviously wearing a mask would be totally prohibitive. How are school districts preparing to bring back these kind of programs, and if it is going to have to be something that is entirely virtual, how can school districts overcome that obstacle?
Yeah, you need the band all in the same room. I totally take your point, Evan. Thank you for calling. Have you heard anything about that, Madeline?
Yeah, that's a big challenge. Some have recommended having maybe the students use the same instrument and avoid brass and wind instruments that kind of expel air, but maybe stick to percussion and piano and things like that. And just try to maintain social distancing. I spoke to a school in Taiwan, and they actually had their choir still going on, and so they had their students wear masks while singing, but be very spaced out, all facing the same way. So they're making it work, but it's gonna require some tweaks.
Should we assume extracurriculars won't happen in the fall of 2020?
I think school districts are going to try to make that happen as much as they can. It's going to look a little bit different. The school in Taiwan that I spoke to, they actually had their kids do a performance, put on a full play with wearing masks, but to an empty audience. There was nobody in the audience. It was just filmed for their parents to watch at home. So things like that could be a little bit creative ways. This national association that governs high school sports released some guidelines on how high school sports could look like in the fall. They recommend starting with low risk sports like cross country, and then as transmission rates decline, move on to high risk sports like football, but being very careful and deliberate in the rollout of those sports.
It makes perfect sense that U.S. schools will look to places in the world where students have gone back. It is worth noting that, Taiwan's infection rate is very much under control at this point. I think,
Yes.
for the past few days, they've had 6 new cases countrywide. In some cases, I think yesterday it was 0. So they're in a really different place than we are in the U.S., where case rates are still climbing in a lot of places.
Yeah, absolutely. So those examples might give us some ideas, but they might not be realistic for every school district.
Have you heard from teachers who say, I'm going to have to quit? My health will not allow me to be in this situation every day, and it's not worth it.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I hear teachers are very concerned. When teachers have a high-risk medical condition, whether that's maybe they're older than 65 or maybe they have asthma, then their school district might have to give them reasonable accommodation. Maybe they can work remotely, like we were talking about earlier. But for teachers who just don't feel comfortable, or teachers who have a loved one who is high risk, they don't necessarily have that guarantee. And some are wondering, is it worth it? Am I going to risk my life to go back? And also teaching is not going to look the same. They're going to go back, and it's going to be a very different experience than when they left school in March. So it's, I think, a lot of concerns, a lot of uncertainty about what their plans are.
On the tech side, given that a lot of these returning to school strategies include more time at home than before, more virtual learning, how common is it for school districts to have computers and Wi-Fi hotspots to hand out to students who don't own them?
That was a big push in the spring. I think districts might not have had that before. They're trying to get it now, and that's going to be a big expense in the fall because they have to be prepared for another. If they do plan on reopening full time, they have to be prepared that they might have to shut down again. If it's going to be a hybrid approach, they just need to make sure that all kids have access to technology and Wi-Fi. So that's going to be a big expense for districts, on top of the expenses of retrofitting the school buildings to maintain social distancing.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Bailey on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Bailey.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I graduated from grad school in May, and I'm supposed to be starting my first year teaching high school in fall. And I've already signed a contract. I already have a position lined up, but I'm still second guessing myself, just wondering if I really do want to go back to teach. Go start teaching at all in the middle of all of this.
Bailey's wondering if he even wants to start teaching. Are you hearing that from a lot of educators who just aren't sure if this, I don't think there's going to be hazard pay, right, for teachers who go into the
Right.
classroom.
Yeah, I mean, I hear, teachers are saying, we didn't sign up for this. We didn't sign up to be healthcare workers or essential workers. Like, this is a really scary, unprecedented time, and I think what Bailey's feeling is echoed across the country in a lot of places.
Let's go next to Kenneth in LaRue, Texas. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
My question for you and Ms. Wells is, are the essential workers being included in planning and creating the implementation of all of the what's going to be necessary to open schools?
Thanks for calling. Yeah, it's not just teachers and principals, is it, Madeline?
No, it's paraprofessionals, cafeteria workers, everyone who, bus drivers, everyone who keeps schools running, have a stake in this. And I think in some places they are at the table in figuring out these plans, and other places maybe not so much.
In every school, low income, high income, mid income, there are particular students who need more help than others. Are there thoughts about what to do about special ed students or students who just would ordinarily be just pulled out of the classroom for a little bit of extra reading or math instruction, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So I think a lot of districts are planning on, if they do go with a hybrid model of some in-person time and some online time, students with disabilities or students who are more vulnerable would go to class in-person instruction all the time, because they really need that instruction. They need that in-person relationship. So I think that's going to be the priority for districts.
There have been times historically when districts in certain parts of the country have, say, a big flare-up of influenza and they close down for a week or two. Are there any lessons to be taken from how school districts have managed those much more localized outbreaks of infection?
I think so. I think that's going to be something that they're looking at. But I think also this is just such a huge scale and so unprecedented that it's still going to be tough. There are just no easy answers for any of this, and it's hard to draw comparisons.
All right. Next, Rosie in Dallas. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. I'm a teacher in Dallas ISD, and I know that one of the things that is most stressful to us is that as of now, the state and local standardized tests are still scheduled to happen at the end of the school year, end of the semester, and our district is saying that they still plan to evaluate teachers using the same system currently in place, TEI, Teacher Excellence Initiative, which makes teachers' salary directly dependent on test scores, and in a normal year, the system's already really dysfunctional since it makes teachers teach the test. But this year, it's especially problematic, and other teachers I've talked to have similar concerns about the continued emphasis on standardized tests when we should be worrying about our students' social and emotional health and about getting them caught up. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of trend or movement nationwide towards suspension of standardized tests and teacher evaluations that focus on standardized tests in the wake of the pandemic.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you know about that, Madeline?
Not a lot right now. I think that's a big question on a lot of teachers' minds is how testing is going to work and how evaluations are going to work, because teachers' jobs are going to look so different. Traditional measures of observation might not really apply anymore. So that's going to be something that districts and states are going to have to figure out how to do early.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I do think it's worth, you know, reiterating that from what I understand, teachers did like a really extraordinary job of adjusting on the spur of the moment. A lot of them, you know, left for spring break and then didn't go back physically into the classroom and found ways to continue connecting with their students. Are you hearing from any of them that they feel like, having given this some thought and had a bit of practice in the spring, they will at least know what to do as they move forward if they're doing kind of a hybrid of in-classroom and virtual teaching?
I think so. I've spoken to teachers who said, yeah, like the last semester in the spring was like drinking from a fire hose. Like it was just so much going on and it was all so new. And now maybe in the fall, they knew what worked and what didn't, and they can kind of manage it a little bit better. There's some precedent.
Do we know how school districts are planning to pay for all this? Most of them are mostly locally funded. They get some state funding, and just a small fraction comes from the federal government. Cities and states in particular do not have unlimited funding and are also trying to pay to control these outbreaks.
Yeah, that's a big question. One estimate found that the average school district is going to have $1.8 million in new cost just to retrofit their buildings. And like you said, like the state budgets are being cut. I mean, it's not, there's not a lot of money. So I think schools are hoping that there might be a federal bailout with schools, more money going in that way. Unfortunately, some districts are turning to layoffs to make money, more money. For example, one district in Washington State laid off several, almost about 100 paraprofessionals and reduced the hours of several more because they said, well, we're not going to need them if our students aren't in the classroom full time. And maybe that'll give us some more money to put back into the building for other measures.
At least in Texas, there are a lot of portable classrooms in use. You know, the weather is reasonably conducive to this sort of thing. Do these exist all over the country? And I wonder if portables now actually seem like a good idea rather than an inconvenience.
Yeah, that's a interesting point. I think those are, you know, in places across the country, especially where the weather works, and that could be an option for schools. A little bit different than the outdoor classrooms that we talked about, but similar idea. Districts are just trying to find any space that they can to put students in.
Do you have a sense of what the majority of districts around the country will do of these schemes we talked about, of the multi-track system or the bubble method or, you know, year-round schooling, cyclical lockdowns? Do you have a sense of what most school districts will do, or is that all still up in the air?
It's hard to tell right now. I mean, we have Los Angeles, the second biggest district in the country, saying that they're going to go all remote, not no in-person at all. New York is doing a hybrid approach where it's multi-track, where students are coming in on different days. That might be the more, out of the hybrid options, that might be the most common. But I think it's going to depend on the state and the district if they're going to go remote or try to do a hybrid.
It'll be interesting to see how kids do socially after several more months of schooling like this.
Yeah, I think that's a big concern for a lot of educators and parents.
Madeline Will is a reporter for Education Week. Madeline, thank you so much for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your patience with our technical glitch during the middle of the hour. So thanks.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. You can also listen anytime on our website. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.